Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to New Orleans. I did my grad work in Houston, so I've been here a few times, usually not to promote anyone's health, including my own. So happy to be here for a new cause. It's really an honor for me to be here today, too, because this is 1 year to the day that I officially joined agricultural health and safety as a discipline. I joined the National Farm Medicine Center after doing my doctoral work in cultural anthropology. So I'm going to start off with a little bit of my own background, just because anthropologists in ag health and safety are few and far between, so sometimes we should say why they're there. Then I'm going to talk about some of the meta changes that have been occurring and will continue to occur in agriculture, especially in the United States. Then I'm going to dive into a little bit of theory with the anthropology of ethics, and this is the one slide I've got, and it's going to help me through that section. Then I'll move into some of my thesis work regarding agrarian ethics, and then at that point we should probably approach the question, what does that do for us in ag health and safety? So we're going to try really hard to do that and do a little bit of foregrounding for my colleagues as well. I grew up on a farm and ranch in southeast Idaho. We raised barley, wheat, alfalfa, limousine, Angus cross, beef cows, horses, and I ended up going to college on rodeo scholarship, and so I didn't practice safety. You can tell from the side of my head that I've seen the unsafe side of things in that business. And then my grad work, I was lucky enough to continue my inquiry into U.S. ranching and rodeo, specifically from my mentor, Dr. Fabian, where he was kind of revitalizing Foucault's arguments about ethics for an anthropological twist. So I end up studying farming and ranching and rodeo through my doctoral work in that kind of framework. And then during my last year, I saw this job posted, Indeed.com, National Farm Medicine Center needs an anthropologist. And I said, well, what do they need an anthropologist for? But I'd sure like to find out because it's tenure track. And so now I'm going to dive into the reasons why this might be helpful to have. U.S. agriculture as an industry is very difficult to follow. It's a moving target all the time. There's not one U.S. ag kind of thing. You've got regions that are disciplined in certain crops, certain modes of environmental safety. It just depends, and that's a historical trend. There's never been a constant moment in U.S. ag. It always changes. And the major changes occurring now in agriculture are we have fewer farms but more acreage dedicated to ag. So that means you've got farms that are growing larger coming under one management person or one management cooperative. The other trends that are really relevant, and I think public health people more as much as anthropologists appreciate this, is that the demographics are changing. So as we see this kind of consolidation in land and practice, we actually see a diversifying population. And this includes more women owner-operators, more racial minority and ethnic minority owner-operators, more foreign-owned land, and in category. So needless to say, our constituency, our stakeholders, are a moving target all the time. And I think what's really important about why that can occur at certain moments in time is because agriculture is a decentralized, very decentralized industry. And we can talk about Jeffersonian ethics at this point to say that there's a reason why we don't want to bureaucratically govern our farms. And it's supposed to be some sort of social valuable thing to our country that they be owned and operated by a rural, genteel population. Whether that's a myth or not, that's a tough debate that we're not going to have today. Nonetheless, that means that it hasn't been a regulated industry like others. So factories are miles ahead. Industry is frankly just miles ahead of ag because we've granted this kind of easy, open bureaucratic status of an unregulated ag world. And this includes employee health and owner-operator health and children's health. Because we always have to keep in mind when we talk about farms, farms are a work site and a home. So we're going to cover the whole spectrum when we say that this is a work site with these important features. Now, the National Farm Medicine Center and Ag Health and Safety, they could use an anthropologist for a lot of stuff. We do ethnography, so we do really good qualitative work. We can be a methodologist and be reduced down to a methodologist just to do interviews. We can also do evaluation. We're very good at gathering data to see what people thought of a program. These are the mechanics of it that any anthropologist could do. My particular background, specifically in ag ethics, though, is a new field in itself, and bringing it to bear on ag health and safety was kind of a mind trick. We had to think of why it would fit and why it would help. Studying ethics and anthropology is about a little less than 10 years old, maybe a little more than 10 years old now. And anthropologists have always gone to the field and tried to, and we've learned and heard about what people thought was right or wrong in their society, how they thought they could do good, or what conduct was considered bad. We've heard these kinds of conversations, but we always tended to refrain from categorizing them because we wanted to be relativists. We wanted to say that the rules are capricious, that they change all the time, and so we're not going to make judgment on them. So no morals, you know, are our standard. Or we were going to say that there was like four or five universals. So we're going to be universalists. We're going to say incest, in-group timing. Or is that 5 minutes left or 5 minutes in?
5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes left. And so we were either going to say the rules are capricious, can't change them, don't bother categorizing them, or they're like four or five and they're universal. And through the work of Foucault and James Fabian, we've learned that we can actually get together and see groups that agree on what the rules are. Now, the way we get to an ethical subject, the way we study an anthropological ethical subject, is through an apparatus like this. So you'll see the pentagon here with the words judgment, substance, ascesis, telos, and subjectivation. And I speak Greek to my farmers all the time. They get it. They love it. What those things mean are they're the confines of the domain. These are the things we have to do in order to see whether or not something is an ethical subject. Judgment is deciding what the criteria is, what is good, bad, and how do we recognize the subject. Subjectivation is how does one become, how does one get recruited to be and become that subject. Substance is the kind of the moral fiber, what it kind of consists of its soul, spirit, attitude. Ascesis is just training, like how do you train to become an ethical subject. And then telos is the ultimate goal, when do we know that the ethical project's been complete. So in the world of agrarian ethics, Occam's razor dictates that we should use the simplest model that we can to answer the question. So in the world of agriculture and agrarian ethics, my argument has always been that there's three ethical domains that are the simplest to bring together. And those are kinship, land stewardship, and animal husbandry. Those are the ethical realms that we ask farmers and ranchers to live in, we ask their workers to live in, and that's at the point at which I think our work can intervene, because as things change and new ethical subjects form, if we're on at the table when these things happen, we can help decide what's the judgment, what's the criteria upon which we're going to say that these are good workers or good bosses, good animals, good farms. And we're seeing this all the time. We're seeing new labels for food that help us decide that it's ethical food. Now, we want to extend that project, of course, to the occupational health and safety of the workers. So that's the question we should ask. So we're going to hear more about the expansion of dairy. And what that means in the world of dairy is that it's usually been owner-operator with family farms, but now they're bringing... So anyone who was working on your animals and working on your farm was considered the hired man, was part of the family. So kinship doesn't mean familial relations. Kinship is a moving target. It can change. So you can see farms that are taking their workers very seriously, and they say things like, we want them to feel like family. So workers, if we have a model of employment and a model of labor that brings workers into the fold like kinship, then all of a sudden they're part of the ethical apparatus. But that doesn't mean that we're going to do the things that we need to do just because we've brought them on our farm and their kinship. There are going to be regulations that help us do that through OSHA if you have more than so many employees, things like that. But nonetheless, we're going to still ask our employees to uphold ideals like land stewardship. We're going to teach them things to do what's right for the land and what's right for livestock. So you can see, and if that doesn't happen, that's when videos come out from dairies with employees that are kicking animals or stuff like that. They've been asked to do that. That's not just on the employee. That's a part of the subject of ovation. They've been asked to be that kind of employee, or they've been allowed to be that employee, or they've been taught to be that way. So that's where we can hold employers accountable, is through their implementation of an ethical system like this. So, stop. Okay. I'll close with this, is that when things are changing, and there's a lot of decentralized, because ag is decentralized, there's a lot of running up against industrialization. They don't follow the same rules. They don't want to follow the same rules. They don't want to be told by the same people that tell industry what to do. But at the same time, things are changing. And when things have an opportunity to change, that's when public health, health and safety experts can be a part of the building of the new subject. Now, I think we should insist on doing this in the beginning farmers and ranchers movement. The average age of the national farmer is 60 years old, and in Wisconsin it's older than that. So we need new farmers, and they're doing all sorts of things to recruit them. The USDA is funding. There's federal funds to recruit these new farmers and ranchers, whether they be veterans, minorities, young people. And if ag health and safety can't do things through labor law, then we should be at the table when these people say they want to be farmers and ranchers, help them fulfill that, and then we want our seat at the table to help them decide what is your subject going to be, what's the right and the good kind of farmer to be, what's the good kind of employer to be. So, thank you.
Does anyone have any questions for Dr. Ben Dixon?
Different kind of subject is, do your corporate values come down? So I think they're both they both market themselves as still family-oriented. So, you know, at some point the consumer can have discretion and say, you know, you're expressing these things, but I know it's not happening on the inside, so it's a facade. So that's food choice, shelf choice, those things kind of like that. You can hold them accountable. But I think you're right. It's not just family farms. I think the USDA is trying really hard to keep family farms. And I think the government is never going to have an open campaign. We might ask ourselves, as public health people, you know, if it went totally industrial, we could regulate it. You know, it would be more regulated. If it went full bore over the OSHA limits, we train all the workers, no family farms that are decentralized anymore. But then we have to ask ourselves, do we really want that? Do we like our diverse food system with, you know, different places where we can get food, and do we like a family farm? Well, if we do, then we need to come up with things for the family farm too.
Thank you, Dr. Ben Dixon. Next is Scott Sandberg. His presentation title is Surveillance of Disease and Injury in Wisconsin Dairy Farmers and Workers. Scott Sandberg is a research specialist for the National Farm Medicine Center at the Marshfield Clinic Research Foundation in Marshfield, Wisconsin, and he's a member of the Upper Midwest Agricultural Safety and Health Center. He coordinates a variety of research projects for focusing on ag, health and safety, public health, and geographic information systems, or GIS. Please welcome Mr. Sandberg.
Thank you, Iris. Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, once again, congratulations for finding this room way back here. So as Iris said, my name is Scott Sandberg. I'm with the National Farm Medicine Center, and today I'm going to be talking to you about our surveillance project of disease and injury of Wisconsin dairy workers. No disclosure, I don't have any relationships to get gobs of money or anything. As an overview, I'm going to give you a little history about sort of dairy, our area within Wisconsin, the dairy industry as a whole, and what it's doing in Wisconsin and how it's changing. I'm going to talk about the previous work that's been done in our geographic area, our current work with our incidence and prevalence, and our survey that we're doing. I'll give you some preliminary results and talk about what we're going to be doing in the future. So I'm going to give you a more sort of in-depth history about where we come from. So we're part of the Marshfield Clinic, which is a health system in north central Wisconsin. They've had their own electronic medical record since the early 90s. And within the Marshfield Clinic is the Marshfield Clinic Research Foundation, which has a number of different research centers. We have a bioinformatics center, we have epidemiology, human genetics, and we have the National Farm Medicine Center, which we are part of. And then within the National Farm Medicine Center, we have work with our partners over at the University of Minnesota, the Upper Midwest Agricultural Safety and Health Center, and that's where this project is funded, looking at the surveillance of disease and injury in Wisconsin dairy farmers. So why are we talking about dairy farmers? Well, where we come from in Wisconsin... Oh, sorry. So why are we talking about dairy farmers? Where we come from in Wisconsin, and it's hard, I don't have a laser pointing, I apologize, but...
This is where we come from.
And this is dairy producer density within the state of Wisconsin. So you can see we are really in the heart of America's dairy land. And why are we talking about dairy? Well, we are... UMass is a NIOSH-funded ag center, and agriculture is one of the highest rates of injury in occupation, as we know, and dairy farming specifically is the second highest within the agricultural listings within NIOSH. So it's a very dangerous occupation. Usually all the injuries that occur involve an employee involving either machinery or an animal. It could be crushing bites, or it could be getting caught in PTOs or other equipment falls, things like that. So it's very... It's a very dangerous occupation, as we know. And so what we're trying to do is we want to measure where these injuries are occurring on the farm. We know that they're occurring, but we want to know how and why they're really occurring on the farm. So that's what we're going to do with our surveillance. Again, to talk with Dr. Ben Dixon, this is how our dairy is changing. It's really important to look at the green and the brown, because that kind of gives you the biggest contrast. So what you're looking at is herd size along the bottom, and then percent of U.S. cows. So you can see in 92, we had the average herd size, you know, the larger herd size was between 50 and 99 herd head. And in 2006, you can see that our large dairies are growing. So sort of a different way to display this information is looking at the number of farms and milk production. It's a big contrast. You can see that the farms are getting bigger, as Dr. Ben Dixon was talking about, and that means more workers, so more higher risk of people being involved in injuries, and we're also having more cows, so obviously that's throwing higher risk into the mix as well. Our area that we come from, like I said before, we're part of the Marshfield Clinic Research Foundation, so our epidemiology department has been studying a specific area of central Wisconsin since the early 90s, and this is the Mesas area, which has been published widely. An initial farm cohort was developed out of this Mesa population in the early 2000s, which was about 6,000 individuals, and that included farmers, their spouses, and their children, and they looked at diseases and incidents and injury in that. That was work done by Dr. Greenlee. He's still with our epidemiology department, and Dr. Barb Marlenga, who's still with the National Farm Medicine Center. And basically what they found is there was no increased incidence and prevalence in our dairy producers compared to our other population. Since we're tied to a clinic, we have access to all the health records, which is great from a research standpoint, so we can really compare, you know, those that we know are dairy producers and those who aren't. So what they found and what's led to our current work is this surveillance project overall, but we're really focusing on two main things. That's the population estimates, the AIM 1 and AIM 2, and those are both going to help us achieve AIM 3, and then the natural language processing, that's sort of a data mining tool that I'm not going to go too much into, but that's going to help us sort of look at the flip side of our dairy owners and help us get at our dairy workers. So this is kind of a overall summary of what we're doing here. We have two really different populations that we're looking at. We have our dairy owners and producers, which we can get from our dairy producers list, which is a public available list. If you produce milk and sell it, you're on a list and it has to be regulated. But our dairy workers are much more difficult to find. We know that they're in our electronic medical record, but we don't know how to find them because occupation is not listed in the electronic medical record in ours or any. We have a different medical record from Cerner or Epic. We have our own privately created, actually, medical record. So it's more friendly for research, but we still don't get occupation. So what we did here, for our owners, we know who they are. So we're looking at their incidence and injury compared to our the rest of our population in our health record. Then we were going to work with NAS, and I'll kind of get at this later, to try to help us with doing the second part of our project, which is our survey, but that didn't work out so well, so I will touch on that. But the NLP, which is a natural language processing, what we're doing is we have a set of known dairy claims from our, let's just go into the incidence and prevalence. So this is what we found when we compared our dairy producers with the rest of our medical record. As you can see, there was no statistically significant information, but which was very interesting is that we found with our risk ratio, and I apologize that I don't show it up here, for a couple categories actually showed that farmers had a lower incidence of injury than the rest of the population, which obviously is a red flag. That's why we're here. We're talking about this. So what this really comes down to is our contaminated control and our dairy workers that are in our electronic medical record that we're not accounting for when we're doing this incidence and prevalence. So just to give you an idea, for the dairy producers alone, there's only 1,200 events, but for the other side of the control, it's 75,000. So we know that that's a big contaminated control, and that's what we're trying to use the natural language processing to help us whittle down. So our survey that we sent out, some of the issues that we had with our institutional review board and NAS, because we are a covered entity and we're asking questions in our survey about injuries or illnesses that farmers and farm workers have, that becomes PHI. And PHI and things that go through federal government are FOIable. But NAS has a certain agreement with their farmers that they don't undertake any projects that are FOIable, and because we did not have a memorandum of understanding, our information, had we gone through them to do the survey, would be FOIable, and thus the PHI would be public knowledge. But NAS just chooses not to deal with anything that is FOIA-able, so we could not go through them, unfortunately. So we decided to do our survey in-house. So I use GIS, since my background is in GIS, to determine our population. So the sort of heat map in the back is the dairy producer density around the Marshfield Epidemiologic Study Area. However, the central mesa really doesn't account for the areas of high dairy, because that's not what it was originally intended for. It was just a service population. So we added zip codes around it to include about 1,600 of the dairy producers in our area. And this was done because we have the National Farm Medicine Center has a good local branding, and we're very familiar to the area. So our dairy producers list, for the whole state of Wisconsin, there's about 12,000 dairy farms. 11,000 of those were geocoded with ArcGIS, and our dairy, what you saw on the previous slide, was about 1,600 dairy operations, or 15.1% of all the dairies in Wisconsin received our survey. And the survey has a wide array of questions. We ask both about the operator themselves and their workers. That was, even though we spell it out very blatantly in big, bold letters about who to consider workers and that they should need to consider themselves as workers, there was a lot of misunderstanding when we got them back as far as, you know, comments like, well, we don't have any employees. Well, but then in our later section, when we ask you how many people work on the farm, there's 8 people working on the farm. So, yes, you have employees, but they're your children or your family. So it's very interesting. A little bit about dairies 101. So this dairy up here is about 50 head. And down here you can see it's a larger, it's more spread out. It's about 500, just to sort of give you a perspective of what we're dealing with here. In terms of parlor, so when the cows actually go to get milked, this is a tie-style barn. Now, nobody really milks by hand anymore. It's an automatic milker, but you can still see that there's a possibility for crushes and biting and other sorts of bad things that can happen with that style of milking. On the bottom, in the parlor, so the farm up on top had a 60-head. That's about a typical 60-head farm. Down here in this automatic parlor, if you count all those up, there's already about 40 cows on that parlor alone, and this facility has about 2,000 head of cattle. So you can see the workers really have less contact, and there's a bar in the back, you know, to keep from kicking. It's just a much more safe way of milking. So our initial response rate was less than desirable. We mailed it in May 1st. We only got about 190 responses out of 1,600, which is unfortunate. But we did get we are getting them from where we expected them to be, and as far as our demographics, we really think we nailed our population. Just some preliminary findings: median age 52. We did have some women. We also noticed that a lot of women were filling it out in place of their husbands, just from handwriting. But some women actually identified themselves. Preliminary findings: skid steer was by far the most commonly used piece of equipment, and that really accounts for a lot of injuries that we've seen. We kind of get a newspaper article posting from a Google search, and we see a lot of skid steer injuries. And it's more commonly used than a mower or even a baler. Unfortunately, safety training, there's very, very little safety training provided. At least there is PPE training for more individuals. About 25% were members of the Farm Bureau, which was the most popular. There's lots of comments from sort of that lost generation, people born in the 70s that grew up or were coming of age to start farming in the 80s when farming was bad. And we actually have a good partner with the Farm Center. He said during the 80s when he was getting ready to go into farming, his grandfather refused to sell him the farm because agriculture was so poor in the 80s. So people in that generation that filled out our survey, actually, we found the most comments and sort of a overall negativity kind of, I don't have any employees, or this doesn't affect me, things like that. And we used a dairy producers list from 2012, and we did find that 7 farms actually ceased operation. They were kind enough to mail the survey back to us, telling us that in 2013 they ceased operation, but did fill it out for 2012. So, and this is a very telling graph, I think, and this looks at so you're looking at herd size versus parlor type, what we talked about before. So you can see that even in just our very preliminary results, the herd size from 50 to 99 is the most common, the tie stall pipeline, where they have that more direct contact with the animal. And as we get up, you can see the herringbone, which is also more physical type of structure, and there is issues for, or there is the chance of pinning and crushing as well, but it's really that tie stall in that 50 to 99 is a really, really telling. Next steps, we're going to prepare for our second survey, look specifically how to increase. We had a pretty lengthy section about injuries and specific illnesses, so we're going to try to increase that response rate. Better target farm workers, and that's sort of what our NOP is going to help us do, sort of find that. We need to find that population in our health record and uncontaminate our control. So acknowledgments and any questions? Go ahead. I haven't touched too much on that. That'd be a better question for Amy here.
Yeah, so dairy is a really interesting. I think dairy is going to lead the way as far as how ag can work with the migrant labor force, specifically because you milk cows 24/7, 365. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, there's no time off. There's no reason to leave, and so they have more opportunity to integrate into community. Become more visible, not invisible workers, but visible workers. And so many of them have on-site housing if they're getting up towards 30, 60 employees and stuff like that. But housing is not perfect. So, I mean, housing could easily be linked with some of their health issues if they're not equipped for this new and really kind of bursting labor force. But they usually are pretty close to it.
We have time for one more question.
I apologize. I didn't preface that. The main concern is we're concerned about how this technology is changing with our changing dairies and going to more larger scale, more automated things. Is that decreasing the incidence of injury? And that's it's preliminary, I guess, right now to say based on our survey. But we did ask that. We asked very specific questions about the type of milking. Because usually when the injury happens, it's during that milking period. So we asked very specific questions about the type of milking setups that they had. And unfortunately, and they had a great response to that, but the injury response on the injury side, they didn't really respond that well. So we can't really make a good comparison. So with this sample so far.
Can I ask one? Sure. Next year, our electronic medical health record is going to add occupation to the field. And so they should be able to build retro relationships, but that's 12 months on.
We have time for question and answers later on at the end of the session, so please save your questions for now, and we can move on to our next speaker, Amy Liebman. Amy Liebman's career is devoted to improving the health and safety of disenfranchised populations. She serves as Director of Environmental and Occupational Health for the Migrant Clinicians Network, and established a national initiative to reduce risks associated with the environmental occupational hazards by improving clinical knowledge and practices, as well as community outreach and education. She's also been a national leader in bringing culturally appropriate approaches, such as Promotores de Salud, to EOH efforts in order to educate workers and communities. Presentation is All That We Heard, using qualitative methods to understand language, barriers, and challenges in the changing dairy industry. Please welcome Ms. Liebman.
Great. Well, welcome everybody, and I just wanted to say, in addition to the lovely introduction that Iris gave me, I'm excited to be the incoming chair for the Occupational Health and Safety section, and I welcome all of you, if you're not a member of our section, to join up, because we would love to have you there. So I want to talk about several projects that we're doing in conjunction with the National Farm Medicine Center and the NIOSH-funded Ag Center, Upper Midwest Agricultural Safety and Health Center. And really looking at all that we heard, and it's not a misspelling, we're really trying to talk about some of the formative research that we've done, listening to workers, farmers, and various other players in the dairy industry. I don't have anything to disclose. So I want to talk about our process. I want to talk about some of the results that we found, and also take a look at how we use that data to design our projects. you've heard a little bit from Cap and Scott about the dairy industry, but I just want to underscore a couple of things, is that the context in which we are working, in which we are trying to design these projects, is that we are looking at an industrialized modern dairy. It is a huge industry. It's about $140 billion industry in this country, and it is that kind of an industry because of modernization, but also because of the immigrant labor. And I really want to underscore that dairy would not be where it is today without the contributions of immigrant workers. About half the dairies in the U.S. are using immigrant workers, and 62% of our milk supply is brought to us by immigrant workers. So, and then I think we've touched on this a little bit, but we're also entering in and trying to design programs and understand an industry that has an enormous long history of agricultural exceptionalism. When we look at the core laws that in labor in this country from the 1930s, from the National Labor Relations Act to the Fair Labor Standards Act, agricultural workers have been historically excluded. There are some exceptions. Some states allow workers to unionize. There have been a few changes in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which, you know, brought us minimum wage, brought us child, you know, end of child labor, overtime pay. There are a few exceptions here and there, but by and large, agricultural workers are excluded. Workers' compensation, another core part of worker safety, agricultural workers are excluded. Only 14 states, and that includes Washington, D.C., require employers to provide the same workers' compensation insurance to agricultural workers as they do to other workers. That's not to say in the other states that we don't have workers' compensation. It's just different. So, for an example, in Wisconsin, most employers are required to provide workers' compensation if they employ 3 workers. If you are an agriculture employer, you have 6 workers, so there's a difference. And then we look into the 1970s and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and from the very get-go, they have left agriculture out of the mix there. They have very few regulations that deal with agriculture, and every year Congress says to OSHA, you may not use federal funds to enforce laws on farms with fewer than 11 employees. So we're really looking at an industry, regardless of how it got there, but right now it has a lot of hired workers, and it's very unregulated, and the workers are not protected in the same way that other workers are in other industries. And so within that context, we wanted to take this public health approach and really look at what's happening with the workers, what's happening in dairy, and that's the surveillance project. We wanted to also say, okay, what can we do to prevent injuries and prevent hazards, and that's our Seguridad en las Lecherías program, and Patricia will be presenting on that, but that really looks at working with farmers to reduce hazards and working with workers so that they can be trained in health and safety. And then the return to work, which Iris will talk about, is really looking at, okay, so what do we do with an injured worker? It's a really nice mix of groups. Migrant Clinicians Network, my organization, brings 30 years of worker health and safety and the immigrant population to the mix, and then we have research experts and occupational and environmental medicine specialists involved, and we're pleased to be funded by the NIOSH Ag Center UMASH, which when you get these little notices about cuts, that they want to chop UMASH off the block there. So what did we do? We talked to a number of agents, people who are working in the in-dairy. Ag Extension does a lot of work with helping farmers with the production process. We talk to different trainers. We talk to farmers and supervisors, dairy industry representatives, clinicians, and then immigrant workers. And I presented extensively on the immigrant workers last year, so I won't get into too much, but I will sort of combine some of the results when we're talking about what our findings were. We also looked at insurance carriers, researchers, and then we did a very in-depth look at farms through observations and documentation of hazards and workers via images. And we're grateful to Earl Dotter, who many of you know his work, who helped us with our initial documentation process. So the common themes that we found across all these different players in the dairy industry was that there was indeed an interest, a desire, as well as a need to improve health and safety. We also found that there was not a culture or a historical practice when it came to safety. we are indeed, while we are looking at, you know, we would look at corporate farms, we are looking at farms that you had the owner operator grow up on that farm, and now in order to survive they've expanded and they're hiring workers. They bring to that mix their own attitudes and their own perceptions about health and safety. And we also found that, by no surprise, that there was a lack of knowledge and just about what safe practices were, as well as what a safe workplace looked like, and limited resources, both for the worker and for the farmer. The injuries, I think were pretty clear. We didn't find a whole lots of differences from the different folks. Musculoskeletal issues, chemicals, animals, slips, trips, and falls, and machinery and vehicles. And the workers really did, because we talked mostly to the milkers and the pushers, they really did talk about their injuries involving animals. We observed, heard about numerous unsafe practices, and we also realize what we knew, but basically there's a limited record of what's happening, and a lot of that has to do with, a lot of times we go to workers' comp records to find out what's happening. So, you know, just because we have a weaker workers' comp system, we're going to have limited data. We also have, you know, an industry, even though they are regulated by OSHA, if you have more than 11 employees, they may not understand or know about the 300 logs. So there, we don't have a lot of real data to sort of fall on. And this is just an example of a practice that we observed. This person is mixing copper sulfate. Copper sulfate is used to walk the cows through to get a foot bath and make sure that we're not spreading diseases via their feet. And copper sulfate is a chemical that requires safety glasses or a facial guard, as well as a respirator, that a dust mask, basically. And so this person at least is wearing gloves, but I just thought it's really interesting to sort of see the chemicals coming up, and that's just a norm. We were aided very much by the OSHA Local Emphasis Program, and I want to really underscore that regardless of how we feel about regulations in farming, it was a great thing in terms of being able to get onto farms and get interest. And one of the farmer representatives was like, or said to us, like, don't tell anybody I said this, but this is actually a really good thing. And it is. It was a motivator. And farmers really wanted to say, what is it that we need to do to address health and safety? And I don't want to be all sort of like naive about this. Wasn't that, you know, like, oh, we love OSHA, come on in. But it was a really important factor in the work that we're doing, and also the motivators for the farmer. OSHA, also, it's important to point out that they really did not have a lot to fall back on in terms of their experience with animals. And so when many of the injuries are happening with animals, OSHA was like, you know, what to do. So they also had few resources to offer farmers. So some of our findings from the those are some of our common themes that came out of from all of our informants, and just to highlight some of the different groups of informants that we talked to. The insurance agents were really an interesting group of folks to talk to. They pointed out that there was really a disconnect between the farmers' understanding of what they were paying in terms of their workers' compensation insurance and safety. So basically, if you have fewer injuries and a safer farm, you're basically going to have a lower mod rate, which means that you're going to pay cheaper insurance. And they really pointed out that there's just a disconnect between the economics of safety and the potential financial benefits for that. They also pointed out that in this culture and in this system, that the idea of return to work is kind of foreign, and that farmers are much more comfortable with workers coming back to work when they are 100% ready to return to work. And you know, one of the goals of the workers' compensation system is that we return workers to work as soon as possible. And it's good for the worker if they can work. It's good for the farmer because they have fewer missed days. But there's this, what do we do with someone who's not 100% perfect? And then the insurance agents, because they also work in other industries, were like, if return to work can work in other industries, we feel it certainly can work in farming. And they really encouraged the center to continue with their work in designing a return to work tool. The clinicians, they too were also interested in return to work. You know, coming from Migrant Clinicians Network, I thought we could have talked to some more primary care providers. But what we did get from the primary care providers is that they really wanted to make sure to do not throw another form on our plate or another thing to do unless you keep it really simple. And they also underscored some of their patients' reluctance to use the workers' compensation system, a fear of, not just fear of using the workers' compensation system, but they don't want to get denied. They wanted to make sure that if there was some other mechanism to get their claim paid for, they could get it, and they did not understand the workers' compensation system. There was also fear of job loss and lots of confusion in terms of health insurance versus workers' compensation. We also talked to trainers, and they were an important group of folks for us to talk to, particularly for the Seguridad program, and they underscored a number of themes for us, in particular, really emphasizing that we are going to be dealing with a LEP, limited English proficiency population, low literacy, and really making sure that we remember that, recognition of that. Also underscoring the different work experiences, reminding us that, you know, the workers that are working on the dairies in Wisconsin may have agricultural experience, but it certainly is very different from this industrialized system. They have talked a lot about cultural differences and cultural differences in the workplace and how one responds to the boss versus what our culture is like. And they also emphasize, be sure to talk about what workers can do and not just make it relevant to them. So our focus groups, and I talked a lot about this last year, but the participants are really reflect the immigrant worker in agriculture. We're looking at folks who do not have a lot of education, folks that are relatively new to the U.S. and new to dairy. And one of the things that we did find is, you know, 80% are men, but there's also 20% women. And we sometimes forget to talk about the women, but they do make up about 20%. And anecdotally, as we've done our projects, we really actually feel that that's going to be an increasing population to look at and important to look at. And this is just underscoring just some of the hard, dirty work involved in dairy. It is not an easy job. The workers, I talked a little bit about the injuries before, but they did also talk about the varying scenarios in terms of benevolent management to neglectful or even harmful and threatening behavior when they did report injury. So there was a real mix of how that was handled. They talked about fear of job loss, fear of income loss, fear of deportation in terms of reporting their injuries. And then also it was very clear to us that there was not a lot of knowledge at all about what rights they did have. Workers' compensation, there was lots of confusion. We actually really sort of boiled it down to really how it was translated and also a difference between the U.S. and Mexican system. So that was really important for us to know as we move forward about that confusion. So how we use the data. So basically, this whole needs assessment process in a lot of ways really validated our ideas. We felt like we were on the right track where we were going. It gave us a much broader understanding of the details of the hazards and the types of the injuries. We also noticed this extremes in worker treatment. I think a lot of us went in to the project with not a naive view, but potentially being different because we were in Wisconsin, we were working with farmers who grew up on the farm, and then we're hiring these workers. It's a little bit of a different model and different type of person than the grower that, you know, I'm used to dealing with in terms of crop labor. But lo and behold, not to no one's surprise, that there's really a variation in terms of the type of employers, and I think that's true in any workplace. It really helped us focus our content and, you know, look at, you know, for instance, we start off our dairy worker training, after an introduction to occupational health and safety, we focus right in on animals because that's really what they want to hear about. It gave us language to use. That workers' compensation language was really important in other ways that people talk about animals and cows. And then it also helped us with marketing. It really was important for us to sort of understand what the farmers want and how they think so that we can have entree onto their farms to do the work that we're doing. Here's a couple of the products just from the Seguridad program. That's the one that I work most on. But we did do a nice comic book on workers' health and safety, looking at their rights and their responsibilities and explaining workers' comp, explaining their rights. And then this is a Susan Harwood OSHA project. This is Seguridad en Palabras. We're looking at a bilingual Pictionary, and that was actually responding to some requests from farmers and workers. And at the very back, there's an emergency sheet so people can fill out where they work and what their contact numbers are to call their supervisor and that kind of thing, and what to do when you call 911. So that's it. Lizzie. Okay, so the question is about workers who were injured, had some sort of contractual arrangement that once they got injured, they were laid off. And I don't know a lot about the sort of the nature of that contract, nor do I, no, nor just... For workers' compensation, there's a large stack of case law that really, your documentation status in workers' compensation, that's actually like the one area where workers, when they get through the system, actually have some ground to stand on. And I do know, and I don't know a whole lot about the Western sort of dairies, but it really is, and that will be one thing that we'll think about in sort of some of the transferable aspects of our programs. We're really talking about some different animals, and we're talking about dairies that were started from scratch in some cases with all of a sudden this 3,000, 4,000 head dairy, and that's a very different sort of setup than what's happening in Wisconsin, in my opinion. But I do think as we look into that, there will be some differences.
Okay, just one more question.
I think it varies, and I'm not maybe cap, you know, but I think it's very different than like the chicken industry in terms of being these contract farmers for Purdue. But in dairy, it's very different, and I think it may take on very different styles.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scenario where you could say a farm wants to be a Walmart supplier, and then it would go to Walmart. Walmart would say, well, you need to have so many cows, so many workers. You need to come up with a standard, and if Walmart's in the business of expanding their dairy resource, then they might provide that and say, you know, we're going to do this type of stall bond instead of this one, you know, with that scenario. More often than not, you're talking about an independent owner-operator that is getting
gaining their own capital, taking loans out, kind of doing a tax procedure to expand and choose their style of production.
Great. So I really love this discussion. This is really great. Please save your questions until the end so we'll have time for the rest of the speakers to present. I know. I'm sorry, Katie. All right, so our next presentation is myself. Title of my presentation is Facilitating the Return to Work of Injured and Ill Farm Workers. This is, Amy has already introduced this a little bit. So what happens when the worker is injured? Or here's a possible solution. My name is Iris Reyes. I am a project coordinator, just like Scott Sandberg, at the National Farm Medicine Center at the Marshall Clinic Research Foundation in central Wisconsin. I'm also a member of the Upper Midwest Ag Safety and Health Center. I coordinate several NIOSH and NIH-funded research projects that focus on improving the health and safety of farmers, farm workers, their families, and communities. Great. So I have no relationships to disclose. Okay, so this return to work program, what is it? What do we want to do with it? So we want to develop a web-based computer applications for clinicians to safely return injured dairy and pork workers to work. What do we want it to do? So we want this computer application to do three major things. We want it to describe farm jobs and tasks. And by describing, I mean photos, measurements of physical demands, such as, you know, how much do they grip for how often, what kind of forces are included, what weights do they have to carry. We want this to be able to generate alternative tasks based on restrictions. So as what Amy has said, workers wanted to let them know, like, what can we do if they're injured? So we want them to be able to give them a list of possible tasks on the farm that they can do despite that injury. And thirdly, we want this application to customize return to work forms or output sheets. I'll go over the current workers' comp report or the return to work form that we currently use and what the problems with it are, and hopefully how we can improve on those issues. So just stepping back a little bit, why we want to do this. First of all, we all know that ag is a hazardous industry. It's one of the most dangerous industries in the United States. Serious restrictive non-fatal injuries happen a lot on farms, especially in dairy and pork, where we're focusing this program on. Physicians are often poorly equipped to manage farm injuries and illnesses. They don't really understand what goes on in the farm, what it means to milk cows. At the same time, farm owners, employers, and workers or employees have difficulty understanding the current return to work sheet, the workers' comp report. So here's what it looks like right now. You can see it's very technical. There's a lot of check boxes. And what happens? So let's say an injured dairy worker comes to the clinic, lets the clinician know that it's a work-related injury. Clinician fills out some of these boxes, check marks them, and then the worker takes this back to the farmer. What do you think the farmer's going to do with this? Okay, so what you can stand 1 to 10% of the time. What does that mean for my farm? And so what happens is the farmer's like, I don't understand this. I don't know what you want to do. So why don't you just stay off work and come back when you're 100%? And also, you know, it's estimated that in dairy farms there's about 50% of the workers are immigrant workers. And so right now this return to work form is not available in Spanish, so it doesn't really help about half the population, the workers, even when they do get this form. So hopefully how we can benefit from this return to work application is we can educate clinicians on what it means to work on the farm and help them better manage the return to work of injured workers. Employers or farmers can reduce their workers' comp costs so that they can return their injured workers earlier to work and not have to pay so much workers' comp for their workers. At the same time, workers can come back earlier and retain their skills and maintain his lifestyle, not to mention his income. So how do we do this? First, we collected job and task measurements. We have certified ergonomists, certified occupational physical therapists, who go onto the farm and measure these physical demands. We conduct usability testing throughout the project period. We are about year four, and so we periodically ask for feedback from our end users, meaning farmers, workers, and clinicians, as we improve this program. We've developed a database, an algorithm that can generate, you know, based on restrictions, what alternative tasks can we have based out of these restrictions. And then at the end of year five, which is in 2016, we hope to pilot this program, roll it out within our internal clinic system with clinicians. So this is a form that we've created for physical therapists. So, you know, they go on the farm, they collect their data, and they come back to the office, and they're able to categorize the physical demands and categorize the tasks and jobs. So we have task name description, how long does that task usually take, up to what time, the environment that it's in, if it involves a tractor, any unique demands related to that task, what PPE is required, and what physical demands that this task require. So lifting, gripping, pinching, standing, walking, those kinds of things. These are photos we've taken. Our IRB does not allow us to take photos of faces for this project, but that's okay. It has not limited us. So this is just an example of tasks that are on the dairy farm. So a clinician would be able to look at these photos and say, oh, I could see this person pulling bar to the hitch means bending over and squatting and lifting. Pushing the feed cart means bending over and pushing. Okay, so we've asked farmers, we've conducted interviews along the way, and asked them, if you have a choice of revamping the current workers' comp report, how would you like it to be? What elements would you like it to have? And so they said, the majority of them said, you know, we really just want a simple form. I don't understand the checkboxes and the technicalities of that workers' comp. Make it simple, make it in layman terms. I don't want to see laceration, contusions. I want to see this is a cut, this is a bruise. They want to see PPE, required PPE, for that injured worker, and they want to be able to see rehabilitation exercises. Maybe that worker will need exercises, and so they want to see, okay, I expect this worker to have to do some squats or something, you know, while at work. They want to see the follow-up appointments of that injured worker so that they can look back at their shifts and have the time to switch around workers and make sure that that worker can go to those follow-up appointments. They want suggestions for ergonomic modifications. This is an interesting one. They want to see how the worker reported the injury to the clinician to make sure that it corroborated with the statement the worker provided to them. They also want clinician's info. Farmers weren't sure if they have the right to talk to the clinician and ask what happened, and so they want to be able to get the email and the phone number of the clinician. They did not want pictures of farm tasks. Actually, some of them were a little bit insulted. Well, we don't want photos. We already know what happens on a farm. We also asked workers. We conducted focus groups, both of English-speaking workers and Spanish-speaking workers. Basically, most of them said, well, we just want the form filled out. Half the time, it's filled out, not entirely, and we don't even understand what's written on there. Of course, Spanish-speaking workers all said that they want it available in Spanish. They also want the clinician's phone and email so that they can contact the providers outside of those appointments. And they want detailed signs and symptoms, like, am I going to get a headache 3 days from now? Is this going to be painful every night, or am I going to have to do something? They want extra materials, websites and handouts, such as rehab exercises, or just learn more about the disease or the disorders they have or injuries. At the same time, also, I was surprised about this, that they didn't want pictures either. Some of the Spanish-speaking workers we've talked to were not literate, but they still didn't really like pictures. Okay, so here's the tough crowd, the clinicians. We asked the clinicians, okay, what do you think about this? Well, they actually did not want to change the workers' comp report. They feel that the complexity is necessary to make sure that they cover all the movements regarding that the injured worker. But if we really have to create a new return to work form, they would like to add some things rather than reducing it. So first, they wanted a job description from the farm owner. But what does the employee really do on the farm or does on the farm? They want the farm worker signature on there to acknowledge that they communicated with the farm worker. Okay, this is what's going to happen to you. Here's what you'll have to do. They want the restrictions on the sheet, not alternative tasks, because they feel that restrictions underline the importance of not having to do something at work or outside of work as well. So alternative tasks only talk about, okay, you can do this at work, but it doesn't tell you you can do this at home. Whereas restrictions, it tells the workers, okay, you cannot stand for this amount of time at work or at home. Translation is helpful, so they all agree at least that it would be really great to have a Spanish version of this form. So here's what we've come up with. This is on the left side is the original sheet, and here's a prototype of the redesigned form. As you can see, it's a lot cleaner. It's more in a narrative format. It's a lot simpler to read. There's no more check marks. Summary is there, injury information, sprained ankle, you know, versus a medical term, possible signs and symptoms, instructions, and how to help yourself at work. So, and then alternative tasks that the worker can do, limitations and restrictions are also included in there. Okay, so this application, what happens is the clinician would go into this application, enter the restrictions of the injured worker, and this is the interface that they would see. They would see different physical demands. They can click on the button, expand button, and input all their data, how long the patient can lift and carry, which hand, left or right, how much weight that this person can carry, how high off the ground. And so we ask clinicians, okay, what do you think about this prototype? We actually got mixed reactions. But that's okay, our project's not over, and this is, you know, why we ask for feedback, to continually improve it. They said, you know, this is way too many buttons, we don't have time to even work with this. And unless it is integrated with our current healthcare system, we don't really want to use it, which is not so good for us. They also want their MAs to fill it out instead of them. They don't want to basically learn a new software in order to work with their injured patients. They wanted to resemble the current return to work form, these output sheets, rather than the simpler prototype that we provided. And again, they want less buttons to click on the software. And they do love the pictures. So this is at least one positive thing that came out of this feedback is they also even want videos of tasks, not just pictures. So that's something that we'll have to think about. Okay, so our next steps is to continually modify the interfaces based on feedbacks from our different end users. We want to continue interviewing clinicians, not just within our healthcare, not just within our clinic, but also start looking at interviewing clinicians outside of the clinic who uses different electronic health record systems. And then, of course, we want to conduct more focus groups of English-speaking and Spanish-speaking workers to refine this program. I think that I'm out of time. Great, thanks. Question? Both primary care and occupational med physicians.
Because I would think the occupational health physicians would be much more attuned with this type of form and would be more willing to spend time on it.
Yeah, no. We were hopeful of that too. That's really great.
What software do you use?
It depends on the clinic, but there's SysFax, Scolus, there's OHS, you know, there's a number of off-the-shelf software that are common in the industry.
Well, that's really great feedback, and if you want to test this program, when you're five, I'd love to take your card. what question? Over here. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask about, is there a
understand what we're thinking is maybe clinicians will have to still fill out that form, but then it's going to be linked to output sheets that can be customized to the end users. So clinicians can see that form, but then the end users, farmers and the workers, will see another form, just translating that technical form into something more usable. Yes, yeah. The forms can be printed off. And then also, on the back end, they don't necessarily have to enter any information. There's a library of jobs and tasks that the physicians can peruse. That's a good question. From what I understand, they really just want one page. Let us know what we can do. And photos take up a lot of space. And so it may be that, the next time I have a focus group of Spanish-speaking workers, we can definitely clarify this. But we're very clear, and we let them know that we do not take photos of their faces. That if we were to take photos, and we already have the photos required anyway, if we were to take photos, it will just be their back or parts of their body.
You could give them some samples to look at of one page with photos on it. Like, here's a sample we could give you versus one page with no photos.
But maybe you are saying getting information from the worker about the injury, then getting information about what to do in a pamphlet or a flyer. That's different. So I don't know if the workers understood the purpose of the photos, either of the injury.
Thanks. Yeah, no, those are great tips, and I'm happy to take them back to my team and figure something out. Thanks. I think we have, is it one more? Just
no.
Oh, okay. Our next presentation is Beyond Worker Training, the Role of Community Health Workers in Sustaining Safe Practices in an Occupational Setting. This is by Dr. Patricia Juarez-Carrillo. Dr. Juarez-Carrillo lives in the U.S.-Mexico border and works on environmental health and occupational issues. She's a coordinator, consultant, and a lecturer on environmental justice at the University of Texas in El Paso. She is a board member of the Keep El Paso Beautiful and the co-leader of the Environmental Education Task Force of the Border 2020 EPA Binational Program. She believes in the importance of education and communication of risks and preventative measures through cultural and educational approaches. Please welcome Ms. Dr. Juarez-Carrillo.
Thank you. Thank you for being here and being part of the HEART. I have no relationships to disclose. I'm still poor. This is the outline. I will talk a little bit about the community health worker model, the promoter model that we have, and how we adapted that model to the occupational setting. Maybe you are aware of the community health worker model. This is a very common leader in the community that transfers and links healthcare issues and health information with the community. And it's usually someone from the community with their own background and description, and it's a peer-to-peer education. they usually use popular education methods in their own language and very easy to transfer information. That's basically the community health worker model. Even here in the APHA conference and in the sections, we have a community health worker section, per se. So this is the Seguridad en las Lecherías, and this is our project team. I think I'm the one in the back, right there. We are the Seguridad team in collaboration with the... No, you are not there. Only cows. Sorry. Well, we have a bull there, Matt Kiefer. This is, well, Amy already addressed the changing industry in dairy farms. It's becoming more, becoming less familiar, family-oriented to more industrial industry, and it's basically made from immigrant workers. And made, I mean, they are the ones who are produced, taking the milk. 88%, almost 90% are from Mexico, and of course they have limited educational background from the country. So we are trying to implement our research here. Even if we are using a new model, we want to test it. So we have the farms that are participating in our study. We are randomizing them into this randomized control trial into the participating farms with promoter model and farms without the promoter model. All the farms are receiving training through a curriculum that we are developing, and also an audit that says what are the risks and what are the hazards in the farm to help the farmer address those issues in the future. So far, in about 18 months, more or less, or less than that, we have already addressed 11 farms with the full model and 44 farms with educational intervention and auditory services. This is our educational concept. We are addressing the hazards in the farm, how to control them. We're addressing cattle issues, equipment and machinery, workers' rights, and chemical and confined spaces safety. And we are based our design on the needs assessment that we already are doing and done, that Amy explained, with workers and farmers. So we are focusing our educational project with a high orientation to Mexicans, but also we have Guatemalans and Central Americans. We have in consideration the low literacy of workers, even though we have discovered that we have zero educational background to even college education. We have some university-trained people working on the farm. So we have a big spectrum, and we have to address that. And also, we are basing our educational techniques in significant learning and learner-centered approaches. We are using the popular education technologies and concepts and model, and the health belief model, with the purpose to increase self-efficacy in workers to change and transform that knowledge into practice and feel comfortable with doing that. So far, we have trained 500 workers in 40 farms, almost 9 workers per farm in average. And so far, we have 11 farms with promotores. We have, in average, 2 promotores per farm, more or less. So after the training, we are asking participants, what did they learn and how confident do they feel to do changes in their lifestyle and in their work site. So they say that they are washing their hands more often. That's a big step because they are surrounded by manure all the time. So that's a big step. Changing behavior is the purpose of this training. So washing their hands is a big yes for us. Wearing the PPE, the personal protective equipment, that's also a huge step in workers. These are their words. And so workers are saying, I'm wearing more PPE because I have to take this seriously. I mean, being injured or having a disease is now thought after the trainings that it's an important issue for their lives. And a comment very interesting, they say, be careful and be careful. That's what I learned. That's what I want to do. And also another important thing that they are learning is to communicate between co-workers about a new cow, about a sick cow, about something happened here, and what do I need to do? Communicate to the supervisor, to the co-workers, and to the farmer if he's available. Now, the promotores de seguridad, this model that we are implementing here, testing here, is based on the same educational baseline that I showed for every other worker, but we are making sure that the promotor de seguridad knows a little bit more and knows and is sure that the information he's transferring to the co-workers is accurate and is updated. So we are training the promotores to learn how to transfer that information, how to approach the other workers, how to listen carefully, what to say and what not to say, not to transfer information from one worker to the other to maintain confidentiality and all those issues, and also how to report to us and to the farmer about any potential hazard or risk or injury that happened. The role of the promotor is very important. It's not going to be a special worker in the farm, but it's going to be a liaison between the workers and the farmer. And that role is very carefully designed not to take to go up in the hierarchy of the farm, because it can cause also problems between other co-workers. The promotor is being named or nominated mainly by the farmer. And sometimes when we are training the workers, we see who is very active, very interested, and has the leadership capacities to become a promotor. So those are the roles of the promotor. We also support the promotores all the time in terms of maintaining their self-efficacy in becoming a promotor in the work site. We are calling them every month and asking him, mainly, I will give you some characteristics of them, but mainly are men. We are calling the promotores to ask them what are the hazards they observed during the past month, what are the injuries that you observe or hear from other workers, what are your recommendations to the farmer to change in the farm to prevent future injuries. And besides that, we also call them every 3 months to collect more information about changes in the farm. And every 6 months also, and at the year, we will collect more information. So we will have a set of information to see if that farm with promotores will have less hazards, less risks, and more knowledge from workers than the farms who do not have a promotor, which do not have a promotor. So the promotor has different tools. The promotor has a flip chart with a PowerPoint presentation and all the instructions in the back, has handouts and comic books, and has the okay from the farmer to organize trainings and bring people to the table and meet with them at lunchtime and give more information and reinforce information, which is very, very important. Preliminary outcomes from these 22 promotores that we have, 83% are Mexican. We have some Guatemalan and a low percent of Honduran promotores. The age is a very young population, 33 years of age. 44 of them live on the farm. Not everybody lives on the farm. They have around 9 school years. However, we have a very good promoter who has 0 literacy level. And he's very active. He wants to be a promoter. And say, well, we say, well, that's okay. But we are paying him with another promoter that has 9 years of education that covers that insufficiency in literacy. Mainly, they have 12 years living in the U.S. and 10 years working in dairy farms. A few percent of them have previous training on safety in other farms or in that farm. 50% do not speak English very well. So English is not a requirement for these promotores, but it's desirable because they need to communicate between workers and the farmer. So we ask them, why do you want to be a promotor de seguridad? Well, they say, I want to know more. I want to apply this knowledge. I want to help my coworkers. I want to take more responsibility. So this is a type of not a job per se, but a task that is additional to the general tasks in the dairy farm. They are willing to do. They like to. They are, this is the kind of leadership that we are finding in the farms. They want to do. They want to participate. They want to reduce risks and hazards, and they want to learn more. If in the future this is one of our vision, if this can become a certificate for them and can help them in their job profession, that would be great. Overall, the farms are very excited with the promoter. Sometimes we have to say a farmer, no, sorry, your farm will not have a promoter, because we are randomly assigning the farms to the entire model or to the farm without the promoter. So one example that we found during our needs assessment is that they have only one refrigerator in the cafeteria, and they store food, workers' food, with medicines for the cows. So one of the things that we are saying in our training: don't store together, don't keep together your food with mixed with medicines or something else for the cows. So now they are very happy, because after the training and after the promoter, now they have their own refrigerator. So that's an example of the liaison task of the promoter of talking with workers and with the farmer. And another promoter said that he was so excited about the information, and that he's now the promoter, that he trained his wife. His wife is now working on the farm, and the wife, oh my gosh, she's applying all the things that I'm saying. I don't know, because he's a husband and wife, but well, he is teaching the new worker about the the safety things, and she's doing what he's telling her to do. So this is an example of the leadership and reinforcing information from the promoter. And that's, I'm done. Blah, 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 blah. Now you are. She's asking if we have an incentive for the promotores. No, we don't have an economic incentive. It's only a professional type of informal promotional activity that he can do or she can do. However, the time they take to reinforce education, train other workers, or do observations in the farm is taken from the working time. So the farmer is providing 2 or 3 hours per month, instead of milking cows, to go there and observe and train other promotores. That's an exchange of his work, but it's not economical.
And the second follow-up is, have you done any kind of impact assessment? How long has your program been?
Oh, yes, we just started with this a few months ago. We are thinking of having a post-assessment 1 year after, and we have information about injury. We are collecting information about the type of injuries, number of injuries, and pre-assessment of knowledge between workers of these farms and the farms without the promoter. That's the kind of assessment we are going to do.
We started doing short permits.
Yeah. Well, lunchtime is part of the work time. What do you mean?
When we've done the training, the workers have been on the clock.
Oh, yes. When we do the trainings, they are on the clock. They take out the workers out of their tasks and come to the training very fast for 1 hour, and they return to their tasks.
So your curriculum is for 60 minutes?
Every lesson is for 60 minutes, yes. We have to decide and take out a lot of information and keep it in 60 minutes, sometimes less. And we have, unfortunately, the situation where the worker comes late because of the tasks he's doing, and then also leaves early because he needs to do that stuff.
Last one?
Yeah.
Okay. What proportion of farms decline to participate?
Oh, that's a very good question. I don't have the answer.
Actually, when we recruited, I'd say about the largest 250 dairy farms in Wisconsin, A lot of them we couldn't reach by phone, so we just mailed them recruitment materials. I think our participation rate, those that we were able to contact and those who contacted us back and who agreed to participate in this, was maybe around 14%.
Okay.
And
again, your recruitment was over mail?
There's mail and phone, but we may have the addresses of the farms, but half of those farms we really didn't have phone numbers or current phone numbers. Or if we did, they just never answered their phone.
Mm-hmm. But we have a randomization of farms. When they call, we assign that farm to the complete intervention, or the next one will be to the less complete intervention. So we assign them randomly.
So thank you guys so much for coming to this session. We really appreciate it. I'm glad you found the room. I just wanted to remind you to please fill out your evaluation forms. This will really help us improve the quality of our sessions for next year. The evaluation forms are right next to the projector, and you can just leave them right here. And thank you.